and negotiates with the other. One example is that they announced that they want to impose the biggest and toughest sanctions in history against Russia. Now, on the other hand, as a result of this action, the growth of Russia's GDP is higher than that of the European Union, which said it wanted to finish Russia's work. On the other hand, the oil and gas that reaches Europe, which they said can no longer come from Russia, still comes from Russia. It just happens that it goes through other countries, and because of that, they charge you more. So you have the same oil as before, just a little less volume, and you're paying a lot more money for it than before. And you're no longer dependent on one country, but three or four. And of course, the gas that you are going to get from the US, the US liquefied natural gas, the amount is very small and not enough for Europe at all. And the price is much more expensive than what Russia was giving you. So what a smart person at the center of the unipolar imperial decision-making apparatus would adopt such a stupid strategy.
Cuarto decisional del imperio unipolar decide semejante estrategia idiota.
Una estrategia idiota, como dices tú, Fabricio. De cualquier manera...
A stupid strategy, as you said, Fabrizio. Fortunately, countries have been able to industrialize and ensure their own food security and develop in this direction. This is one of the consequences of sanctions. This is a very complicated matter. On the other hand, there is a very interesting phenomenon, which is the coordination, unity and cooperation between the embargoed countries, which is a kind of resistance and building a different environment.
Que también es una forma de resistencia y de construir un espacio distinto. Mira.
Look, the nations of the sanctioned countries use their intelligence to make fun of many, or in fact all, sanctions. I remember when I was in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, they definitely made fun of some of the sanctions. As I remember that in the period of socialist Albania, in the period between 1976 and 1986, there were large companies producing textile products, and all of their products ended up in the market with the label Made in Italy.
Telares, mucho. Y todos, al final salían al mercado, y estaban en el mercado, con la etiqueta Made in Italia.
This means that nations have the ability to overcome sanctions and blockades in any way. What experience do you have of dealing with and passing behind sanctions?
Para superarlos. ¿Qué experiencia tú ves aquí en el desarrollo desde los pueblos para enfrentar y superar estas sanciones?
La cuestión es incrementar.
The issue is a significant increase in development of South-South relations. South-South relations should take the place of North. Today it is much easier to exchange products with any other country than it was 20 years ago. Every country can achieve a level of production of products and services. The policy of imperialism is stupid because they don't take into account that in the past, until about 50 to 20 years ago, resources were exchanged with technology and its improvements. Today, the owners of resources no longer need new technologies. Because firstly, some countries have very, very advanced technology. And secondly, if a technology doesn't reach them, there are countries that are willing to give the technology, for example, China, Russia, and Brazil itself. So what is the threat where the logic of exchange prevails? When you pay the price of my product at the international market, and if you want, you cannot do the exchange, the idea of you sanctioning me is stupid. You see, they sanctioned the Russian oil and gas pipeline to Europe and wanted to prevent Russian gas from reaching Europe. But what happened was that gas flows from Turkey and Azerbaijan and then returns here. What did Russia do? It used to have a strong trading partner, the European Union, and specifically Germany and two lines that transported oil and gas quickly and directly. For political reasons, he sold gas at a very low price. Today, it sells this gas at a relatively higher price to India and China and to other countries such as Pakistan, countries that did not buy it before. Russia started diversifying its customers and therefore has many more customers than before and is much less dependent on one customer only.
Al diversificar la cartera, a tener mucho más gente que te compra, tener mucha menos dependencia de cualquiera de ellos. la realidad actual donde se comienza.
Today's reality is that countries are starting to do business with their own national currencies. India works with rupees, Russia with rubles, China with yuan, etc. Today, therefore, the dollar is not very decisive. How does this approach affect the possibility of circumventing or neutralizing sanctions?
En la posibilidad de sortear o burlar las sanciones.
Mira, hermano, en una forma muy fácil, es un desastre para Estados Unidos.
Look, brother, this is very easy. It's a disaster for America, because thanks to the dollar, as the only player in international exchange, America was given the ability and power in international trade to determine who sells what and who buys what and the terms of payment, and this way it earns billions of dollars per day per transaction. This situation is not going to continue now. The dollar will no longer be the only medium of exchange. According to the predictions made in a 10-year period, the dollar will probably not be the first currency. Why? Because as always, there's a proverb that says, idiots, in addition to being stupid, also become blind. When the US tried to sanction Russia, it made it impossible for Russia to access the dollar market and the Russian account was blocked, like what they did with Venezuela in the past. Most of the countries in the international level have resources abroad for emergencies that can happen. Now most all strategic reserves have been in dollars. Now, there are many countries that say, if I ever get into a conflict with America for any reason, America will stop me and take all my reserves from me. No, it is better not to do this. And they are de-dollarizing their reserves. There are many countries that willingly de-dollarize their resources gradually without creating a monetary shock. And many more countries are planning to do this. Having less dollars means having less demand for dollars. Less demand for dollars means less production of dollars. Less production of dollars means that the U.S. debt cannot be paid.
Por la deuda de los Estados Unidos, la cara de impagable. Gracias, Fabrizio. Desgraciadamente.
Thank you, Fabrizio. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of the program. Thank you very much for your participation. This is Black and White.
Muchas gracias.
De nada. Adiós.
Adiós.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts of the Leadership on Thursday, 7th of March. The meeting took place at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Thursday, 7th of March, members of the 5th Assembly of Experts had their last official gathering in a meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader started off by recommending to all prayers and supplication in the remaining days of the month of Sha'ban. He said, "The month of Sha'ban is for purifying and enlightening our hearts by seeking God's forgiveness through supplications and prayer. It is the month for preparing ourselves for the abundant and infinite blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. What a person prays for during this month is special. O God, grant me complete detachment from my worldly desires so I can come towards you. O God, give me a heart that longs to be close to you and a tongue that speaks the truth to you." These requests are filled with light, grace, and spirituality. We must say, "O God, if you have not forgiven us yet in this month of Sha'ban, a portion of which has passed, then forgive us in the remaining days of this month. May the Almighty help us make good use of the few days that are left of this month and bestow His grace upon us all." Turning to the well-attended and enthusiastic nationwide rallies and marches on 11th of February and Parliamentary and Assembly of Expert elections on 1st of March, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "February and March of this year revealed signs of Islamic democracy more than in other years. From the 10 days of dawn celebrations to Parliamentary and Assembly of Expert elections in March, all of these are signs and characteristics relating to Islamic democracy and the Islamic Republic." Referring to the birth of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the leader said, "The birth of the Islamic Republic had a global impact. It was an earthquake, a global event, that created two opposing fronts in the world. One front was comprised of democracies dependent on the ideology of liberal democracy, and another front, a republic originating from religion and Islam, and related to religion and Islam. These two fronts were brought into existence with the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they did not exist prior to the emergence of the Islamic Republic. Naturally, it brought complications for both sides. The incompatibility between these two fronts was natural, and it was evident from day one." Commenting further, the leader said, "It should not be imagined that this incompatibility is solely because of religion, where one side adheres to religion and the other side is indifferent about it. It isn't just that. It may appear to be so, but in fact the divisions and incompatibility are far more fundamental and run much deeper. The problem was that this faction of mainstream Western democracy felt that this new model that had emerged was in conflict with its major interests and perhaps ultimately opposed its existence. They sensed this very much. This sentiment was created in general in the opposite side from the outset of the Islamic Republic of Iran's establishment, and it intensified and grew as time passed. This opposition and serious conflict is due to the fact that at the core of the system of liberal democracy and the governments that were created based on that rationale and principle, there is an inherent arrogance, aggression, and transgression. Arrogance here has the same meaning that we use in the Islamic Revolution, that is, it encompasses oppression, aggression, and the violation of other nations' rights. This is in the nature of Western liberal democracy." The leader added, "These governments saw that their wealth, their power and absolute domination depended on attacking and invading weaker nations. This is evidenced by the fact that at the height of the faction's popular slogans, that is, the slogans of democracy, freedom and human rights, that peaked in the 19th century, parallel to these slogans, the largest colonization movement of that faction also took place in the same period of time. In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The peak of colonization of Asian, African and Latin American countries was during the 19th century, and it continued into the early 20th century. In other words, these two events took place simultaneously. Those slogans becoming common in the 19th century and the arrogant movement towards colonialism, which was accompanied by oppression and a disregard for other nations' rights, took place at the same time. Naturally, when there is no spirituality, a background of oppression and injustice takes root. When a group feels strong and is able to exploit and plunder a country, like India, for example, which was wealthy, had industries and was considered advanced at the time, and by using force and pressure can seize control and use that country's wealth and resources to increase its own wealth, power and capabilities, why would it not do so? When there is no spirituality, what is there to prevent it from doing so? It can, so it does, and it did. Colonialism took over in important regions of Asia, including in East Asia, India and surrounding countries. It also took place in Africa and in Latin America. The most important issue of the opposing front, which was created based on a religious democracy, is to confront oppression, arrogance and transgression. That is, the foundation of a government which is formed based on religion and Islam is neither harming others nor suffering harm. Its primary objective is to fight and confront oppression. As the Holy Quran says, those who have faith fight in the way of Allah. This is why naturally this confrontation and mutual hostility came about automatically. This is a reality that came about. Warmongering and endless bloodshed in the pursuit of power are some of the characteristics of the Western liberal democracy, which is formed in the name of this so-called democracy, but is far from spirituality and religion. Many of these tragic events took place in Europe itself. However, they are always united when they're facing non-Europeans. But when they become free from doing that, they're at odds with each other as well. As a matter of fact, the problems and what happened in Europe in the 19th century, the wars, the massacres and the aggression, prove my earlier point. In further comments, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "We're not opposed to other governments and other countries. As a rule, rather, we are opposed to oppression, exploitation, arrogance and aggression. We are opposed to the events that you see unfolding today in the Gaza Strip. A nation, the owners of the land, are subjected to such severe oppression in their own land. Their women, their children, their families, their homes and their infrastructure and all of their belongings are destroyed with absolute brutality and heartlessness, while some countries simply stand by and watch. Not only do they not oppose or prevent these actions by the aggressor, they even offer to help the aggressor. The United States, Britain and some European countries have helped the aggressor." This is what we are saying. We're opposed to this. The things that set the Islamic Republic in opposition to the opposing front are these concepts. In further remarks, the leader said, "The second conclusion that may be drawn is that we need to continually raise the battle flag against the arrogant powers. We need to ensure that the battle flag against the arrogant powers remains in the hands of the Islamic Republic of Iran at all times. We must take the lead and be in the forefront of raising this flag more prominently each day." Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The third and final conclusion that I would like to make is that we must clarify this truth to our younger generation. Our younger generation, our young people, and the future generations need to know what the vision of the Islamic Republic is and why it opposes certain things. Fortunately, of course, in the 4.5 decades that have passed since the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have been successful, both regionally and globally, in conveying this message to the outside world. Conveying the message of the Islamic Revolution to the wider world." Turning to the Assembly of Experts, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The Assembly of Experts are responsible for the most important tasks, which are selecting the leader and overseeing the maintenance of the leader's qualifications. This is perhaps the most important task in the management of Iranian society today. The Assembly of Experts must ensure that the fixed principles of the Islamic Republic are upheld in their decisions and selections. They should take care that the fixed principles of the Islamic Republic are not neglected. This is very important. This means the leader must be selected while respecting and considering the fixed principles that are fundamental certainties in the Islamic Republic." Commenting on the parliamentary or majlis elections, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Each new parliament or majlis brings with it fresh hope and aspirations. With the formation of a new parliament, a new majlis, new hopes develop due to that majlis, and there are new opportunities as well. New representatives enter the parliament and they interact with more experienced members of the parliament. They can use the successful past experiences and implement new ideas, and this is a valuable asset. The formation of a new parliament, a new majlis, is a valuable asset that can be used for the country. This should be appreciated. Fresh blood enters the new majlis or parliament, and God willing, the nation will benefit as a whole." In concluding remarks, the leader wished success for all the new members of the Assembly of Experts, and he wished God's blessing upon all those present.
Discovering Islam.
Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the Day of Judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the Day of Judgment? would they live or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined. The realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life, and that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
Okay, there is the dunya and there is the akhirah. Okay, two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences, which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, Alamul Mithal, or the barrier world, Barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. It cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection.
Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier, something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And, you know, these waters can travel together without mixing because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life and this world and the Day of Judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back or I stay. Come back, I mean, to the intraphysical life, to their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea and, let's say, maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, "Ilmuha inda Rabbi," and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The Day of Judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the barzakh.
What is the purpose of barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the Day of Judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the Day of Judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby, through the influence of DNA, becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter. A world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure. And that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure. No, it's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or barzakh is one step ahead towards the hereafter, the life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there. And therefore it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing with the Day of Resurrection. Everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mithali body is the swiftest thing in moving, relocating, ascending or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years old becomes very relative. The soul is still young, it has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do and they see more than you do."
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are all based on what they have done in this world.
The Islamic tradition has references to three groups. Group number one, the believers. Again, I stress on the fact, believers, not Muslims. A disbeliever can be a Muslim. The believers who have acted in accordance with their faith, they practice what they preached, those will be enjoying some of the features of heaven in that world. On the other side, the second group, the disbelievers, could be Muslims, are unfortunately suffering from some of the punishments that they will be subjected to in the hereafter, after the Day of Judgment. And there's a third group, who some of the tradition describe as they are neither the first group nor the second group. They are a group of people who maybe they were not subjected to enough knowledge. They will be in a state of as if they were asleep. God will just leave them.
For believers, life in Barzakh is going to be fascinating. They live in vast expanses with bespoken landscapes around mansions and palaces, furnished with luxurious furniture in their lounges and rooms.
They are served by innumerable some number of servants with inner and outer beauty, with no purpose but to serve their masters. Now bear in mind that none of these are physical objects. They all belong to the spiritual world, a world an image of which is reflected in our world.
All these are there to strengthen their love and appreciation for the God they are going to meet after this stage of their life. However, we have to be careful not to confuse this exuberant life with what awaits them in the eternal paradise, as the quality of life there is in no way comparable with what they experience here in the middle world.
We have a basic understanding of what paradise has: the beautiful scenery, the palaces, the service, the gardens, But actually there's more to it. Meeting the Lord, proximity to Allah, seeing Allah with the heart, seeing God with the heart, is a theme that the Quran encourages people to think about.
Here we need to talk about one other type of life in Barzakh. The life of those who have died at a young age and have not developed into good or evil souls.
Compared to the grown-ups, the children who die at a young age have one advantage and one disadvantage. Now, on the positive side, they are sinless and hence open to any concept and wisdom that the angels may teach them. On the negative side, they have not developed concepts, feelings, and thoughts which are prerequisite for ultimate wisdom.
The views about what judgment will be passed on those who have died at a young age differ. Most Christian theologians believe that only those children who are baptized would attain salvation. The majority of Muslim theologians, however, believe that every child who has died at a young age would be saved.
If a child dies before he has the mental maturity to choose between right and wrong, that child will continue to exist because he was born for eternity, but he will not, of course, be subjected to any judgment, because he didn't have the mental capacity to choose.
They can only be taught to a restricted degree, and deeper aspects of wisdom cannot be known by them.
These teachings have two aspects. One, to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge that are prerequisites for entering that realm. And two, to cleanse them from the wrong teachings given to them by their parents or their society that is a hindrance for entering the holy realm.
Their purity is very different from the purity of the grown-ups. It is this latter purity and the depth of wisdom corresponding to it which determine the place of every individual in the final abode.
We have people out there who envy those who die at a young age. They say this child, this youth, he died before getting a chance to sin and before getting the chance to become a bad person. He's so lucky. But if you look at it from Allah's perspective, it's not necessarily something good.
Children cannot enter the territory of the righteous immediately after death. They live in a very beautiful interim space under the guidance and training of the angels to prepare them for entering that realm.
It's not an art. It's not something big to evade the punishment of the hereafter. That's not what we're here for. Not going to the hellfire is not something hard. It's easy. Allah's mercy is too great. Allah will forgive with the slightest excuse. What's hard is to gain higher levels of closeness to Him. So this isn't something that we should actually ask for. A person who dies young didn't have the chance to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to be in a bad position on that day, but he won't benefit from all the good stuff either.
One cannot wait to see the wonders we are promised in the world of Barzakh. A world which takes us one step further to our final destination, meeting with the Lord. A world which empowers us to an extent unimaginable for us in this life. However, we have not exhausted all our topics about the fascinations of the world of Barzakh. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about those topics. Until then, peace be with you.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
Tel Aviv is coming up against myriad obstacles, from the loss of Western public opinion to the nervousness of its key backers. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's attempts to keep this war going for as long as possible are not being helped from within. Two senior members of the war cabinet have defied the Prime Minister's wishes publicly. The first act of public defiance came from War Minister Yoav Gallant, who announced that he would only agree to present a new military draft law if MK Benny Gantz's National Unity Party agreed on how to regulate the exemption of yeshiva students from conscription. Gallant effectively gave Gantz a veto on the law, on which government funding to yeshivas whose students refuse to serve depends. Without such a law, Haredi parties would leave the coalition and collapse the Zionist government. The second act came from Gantz, who made unsanctioned visits to the US and Britain, in which Netanyahu ordered his embassies not to cooperate. But such is Netanyahu's political weakness, that neither Gantz nor Gallant can be fired. A third blow to Netanyahu in as many weeks was the recent statement by Sephardi Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, who said that if the government were to enforce compulsory military service on the Haredim, they would leave Israel en masse. Yosef was denounced by a Jerusalem Post editorial that said his words were an insult to the troops risking their lives in Gaza. The Zionist regime's war leader has less and less authority within Israel to conduct war he wants. The balance of power between the child killer regime of Israel and the resistance group Hamas is also not as clear-cut as it might seem at first glance. Another sign of their confidence in their ability to shape the future of Palestine and its leadership is their list of prisoners who would be released in exchange for the remaining Israeli hostages. The latest list includes Marwan Barghouti, the Fatah leader sentenced to 5 culminative life sentences and 40 years in prison for his acts in the Second Intifada; Ahmad Sadat, Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine; Abdullah Barghouti, the Hamas military leader; and Ibrahim Hamid, leader of the Second Intifada. If any of these men were released, the effect would be a strategic shake-up of the Palestinian leadership across all factions. For Palestinians, this would be a huge political renewal. It would also mean the definitive end of a Palestinian authority that collaborates with their occupation. For the Zionist regime, the release of these men would present a real chance to negotiate an end to the conflict. But only the likes of Ami Ayalon, the former head of Shin Bet, gets this point. Instead, the war cabinet's latest idea is to put another PA stooge, Majed Faraj, in charge of Gaza. Faraj's mission is doomed before it starts, and it would be wise to decline such a poisoned chalice. Netanyahu's weakness is having a profound effect on the Western political elites who supported and armed the Zionist regime. U.S. President Joe Biden's rift with Netanyahu is now open and in the public eye. The U.S. leader, who said so loudly that Israel had every right to defend itself 5 months ago, now says Israel cannot kill another 30,000 Palestinians in the name of self-defense. We don't believe Biden has had some dramatic change of heart or that the scales have fallen from his eyes. U.S. government officials are fully informed about what is happening on the ground in Gaza at every stage of his operation. They knew, for instance, that resistance groups were not diverting aid convoys or stealing food, and said so. If Biden is confronting the consequences of having given the Zionist regime the brightest of green lights to invade Gaza after the October 7th events, those consequences are primarily electoral. Biden's team has been shocked by the extent of uncommitted vote. Hundreds of thousands of voters across the U.S. voted for no candidate in the Democratic primaries on Super Tuesday, as the movement urging voters to vote uncommitted gathers pace in protest against Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. This could cost him in the general election in November. Biden's Ramadan greetings were especially warm this year, but Arab Americans don't want hugs. They want a change of policy, and Biden still only supports a temporary ceasefire, not a permanent one. He has not threatened to stop the supply of weapons to Israel. Nevertheless, there has been a deliberate shift in tone. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S., was full-throated in his support for the Zionist regime after the October 7th event.